Hey, welcome to A Little Better. This week on the podcast, we have a special episode that we've been working on for a long time that we recorded with special guests, biblical psychologist Beth Clace, Drew, and myself back in the summer. We can't wait for you to enjoy it as we deal with the practical issues of our current day topic of gender identity. Take a listen, and I hope it's helpful for your walk with Christ. Our goal in this podcast is to know Jesus better and by the power of his spirit, do better so together we can be a little better. Hey, welcome to this bonus episode of A Little Better. We have special guest, Miss Beth Clace, and she taught a recent equip class from a couple of months ago titled, What Does the Bible Say About Gender Identity? And if you haven't listened to past episodes, it's going to be so important for the context of this conversation that set the foundation for this conversation is going to be really centered around application of how do we apply these biblical truths that we've learned from Beth and then put them into play in some real life scenarios. These questions are directly pulled from a feedback form that people who attended that class sent in to us. And so, well, welcome. You ready, guys? Guys ready to dive into this conversation?
We'll see.
Let's do it.
Let's see what happens. So awesome. All right. So, Drew, this first one I'm going to direct more towards you because it's kind of context around Northridge Church. So let's talk about, we use the language around Northridge, welcome home. Is someone welcome at Northridge that may disagree with us on some issues tied to sexuality, the trans, gay, LGBTQAI2 community? Are they welcome at Northridge?
Yeah, 100%. We like to say we like to give people a place to belong before they believe. And so we welcome our doors to anyone and everyone. I think we have to recognize that we are broken people and the place you find hope is Jesus. And so that's our goal, is to open our doors to all kinds of broken people. Hey, I was broken before I walked into the doors of the church, and through Christ I found healing. And so, yeah, it doesn't matter. I think we like to put a stigma on, you know, sexual sin, like it's yeah, way bigger or way worse. And if you are, you know, you're transgender or you're dealing with a homosexual relationship, you are welcome at Northridge Church. It is a safe place for you to come and explore who Jesus is and what he did for you.
Nice. What about some deeper level of not just attending, but what about being active and involved? Can someone be involved and do community group or possibly serve in some various roles at Northridge in that regard? Can they be a part of the church?
For sure. I think with anything, as you begin to lead things, we have different standards for our leaders. So I think there could be some limitations on there for any sin that people are involved in. You know, with our community group leaders, we have a standard that they need to meet. And so all of this journey of like growing in the church, becoming more involved, is a conversation. We don't have a specific standard of you have to meet this perfection, but we have conversations with people. We help people be transformed by the gospel. And so, yes, I do think someone who is dealing with some of these things, there is a place for them to serve, to greet, and there are places for us to have conversations as they grow in our church.
Nice. So let's just get to the root probably of this question is it a sin? And this kind of opens up in the regard of, is it a sin to be a part of the LGBTQAI community, to identify yourself as gay, lesbian, or trans?
Do you want me to do this, Beth, or do you want? I'll start. Yes, I do believe it is a sin. I think the Bible makes it very clear that this goes against God's design for sexuality, for male and female. And I say those words not as this me coming down on somebody, but I say this graciously and lovingly, that you are walking away from God's best in your life, mm-hmm, just like any other sin, mm-hmm, right? Where we choose to live in rebellion to God, we walk away from his best. And I think this is a clear and direct sin according to scriptures.
Yeah, I agree. I was going to say the same thing, just, you know, that ultimately drives me back to design. What was God's design for us? And we see that very clearly laid out, certainly in the creation narrative and throughout the whole storyline of scripture, that not only did God have a design in creating us, but that we as his creation, need to submit to him and live under his authority, not our own desires and inclinations when sometimes they lead us in a very different direction.
Yep. Yeah. You brought up a word desire in the regard of, so could it possible be that someone who identifies with this community of these different sexual ethics or things like that could be born with that desire? You know, there's a lot of conversation in the past several years have been like, well, you shouldn't put different limitations or standards on someone just because they're born this way. How does that conversation around being a part of gay, lesbian, or in the trans community and the nature of being born with it, how does that relate in that regard?
Yeah, I mean, I think that I would be one to say we can't oversimplify this. And it's really easy to say that it's all biological or it's all social or, you know, it's the way you're raised. And frankly, I think it's all of those things that impact our sexuality and our desires. But at the end of the day, we still have to submit to God's authority for our lives. And I think this analogy works a little bit if we think of addiction. I do think that people can be born with a propensity toward addiction. And yet that doesn't mean that we say, well, it's okay, since you were born with a propensity for that, then you should just pursue that. We say, no, I mean, even if you're not a Christian, we generally recognize addictive behaviors are not healthy. Right. So I think, you know, we have to keep those things in mind, that even if you do fully think that this is something that someone is born with the inclination or desire, or, you know, being homosexual or transgender, we still run into problems in that having an inclination or desire doesn't necessarily make it right.
I actually think it fits the biblical narrative, because guess what? I was born a sinner. I was born with sin in my heart, which the Bible makes clear from the creation narrative to the fall, right? Mm-hmm. And when Adam and Eve chose to live in rebellion to God, it created a sinful nature. And so to me, it's a moot point, because I have desires that are sinful in nature. Right. Mm. That doesn't give me an excuse not to live in submission to God, right? Yeah. God's way is best. And you see that at creation, right? The way he created it perfectly was amazing. We broke it.
Yes.
And anytime we live in a manner that goes against God's design, goes against his ways, it breaks us.
Yeah.
And just because maybe somebody was born with an inclination towards the same sex relationship, still doesn't give you an excuse to live against God's design.
Right. Yeah.
Which is hard, but that brings up a word that is not popular in our culture, which is submission. And we're all called as God's creation to submit to his authority. And Beth, you broke that down and unpacked that. And I believe talk one and two. So if you haven't watched those, here's another reference point. Go back, watch those, and get a good reference point for this conversation. So this brings us to our next question, which is, in light of that, can someone be transgender and a Christian?
Yes. Yes. I mean, we are all sinners. So, hey, I'm a Christian. I confess Jesus is my Lord, that he died on the cross and rose again. I still struggle with sin every day. Yeah. And God is slowly refining me and sanctifying me. And, you know, that's a process, and that process won't be finished until I get to be with him. And so I do think there should be, though, to be clear, I think there should be some conviction. I think the Spirit of God should be moving in your heart, where maybe you are living in a sinful lifestyle, but there is this uncomfortable conscience voice in your heart that's saying, this is not what's best for you.
Yeah. I think that I would phrase it that, you know, it's the difference between embracing a particular identity or a lifestyle that goes in opposition to God's design for us, or wrestling with it.
Yeah.
And I think that if you are embracing it, then I would say some problems with that.
Yeah.
But if you're wrestling with that tension and trying to, you know, figure out how to follow Christ in the midst of desires that pull you in a different direction.
Yeah. Which is, I don't want to soften it with this, but I feel like every Christian when, if you're reading the scriptures, they should make you uncomfortable, right. Because they should lead you to self-examination. If you can read through the Bible and read through some of Jesus is saying just in the Gospels about what it means to actually follow him, and you're like, can just read over that, like, okay, good, let with my morning coffee and move on with your life. There's some tension there that I would wrestle through, like, because I constantly, time and time again, almost every morning, when I'm reading through the Bible, I run across something. It's like, man, that goes against what how I'm living my life, and I have to reconcile with that. I think what makes it difficult in this conversation is our culture has constantly pushed what this one narrative down our throats, and it's really different from the biblical narrative where there are other things that it's like they've aligned, and it just makes it muddy in a lot of ways.
And I think some of that is why are you accepting this lifestyle? Is it out of ignorance, right? I just found Jesus and I'm living in ignorance to his ways. Right. I think there's a process of sanctification where it starts with knowledge, understanding where God stands on certain issues. And as you grow in that knowledge, it should transform. Like you said, I'm no longer embracing this. I am wrestling with it. I am trying to seek the Lord and adjust the way I live.
Yeah,
that's good. This question was sent in the feedback form as well. It says, I've heard the argument, a popular argument that God created male and female. In the same way he created day and night, and he created these two things all throughout the creation narrative in Genesis chapter 1 and 2. But in light of day and night, he obviously also created sunrise, afternoon, morning time, but that's not mentioned in Scripture. So there's these phases of the sun and the moon that aren't mentioned. It's not just the sun turns on and then the moon turns, you know, the sun turns off, the moon turns on. It's just not these strict things like that. And the point is made from this argument that in the same way that God created that, when he created male and female, he also created everything in between, i.e. LGBTQAI. How would you approach this argument?
Go ahead, Beth.
Well, I would say two things. I would say, well, maybe three. I would say one that is a bit of, I think that we have to be careful of taking one thing, like the fact that God created day and night, and saying, well, because there's all of these other times of day, that means that gender also includes all of that. That's kind of an extension that we don't quite see in Scripture. But beyond that, I would say two things. One, that while there is variation depending on where the sun is, day is never night and night is never day. So I think that is one issue we would have to wrestle with. And then secondarily, I also think that the Bible does mention sunrise and sunset and high noon, and, you know, other times of day are discussed, but we do not see that happening with gender in Scripture. It's never referenced that there are variations in Scripture. And so those are some of the limitations I see with that argument. You know, I get where people are coming from when they use it, but I see some limitations to it.
Yeah, I also think on that note, I agree with everything you said. And I would just say, when you approach the Bible, that this is truth, not what I want it to be truth.
Right.
And it feels like that argument comes with an agenda, right? Mm-hmm. I want the Bible to say what I want it to say, so I'm going to try to find a way to get the Bible to say what I want.
And there's a lot of people who approach the Bible from very different angles, and they get it to say what they want it to say. It's like, oh, see, right here, I can make this argument, so... all right, let's move to some practical applications of this. So as a Christian, when it comes to people that I'm in relationship with, they may be friends, family members, workplace, coworkers, or anyone in the stream. If they're a practicing Christian, that this person is, and they have a relationship with someone who identifies in the trans community, who is asking them to use a pronoun different from their biological sex that they've been assigned at birth, or maybe it comes out of left field and they have been called one name, and now they're asking them to call them a different name. What should we do? What should this person do? Should they agree with this person and just go with the flow, call them the name they want to be called, the pronouns they want to be used, or should they resist? Should they not do that? Help us think through this.
This is Honestly, I think this is one of the toughest parts about this whole conversation is knowing how to respond to people. Mm-hmm. I'll just share kind of like where I would land on this. And I don't know necessarily if there is a solid, this is the right way to do it and this is the wrong way to do
That's
it.
That's helpful to say out of the gate.
I think there are some wrong ways and there are some more right ways. But the way I approach it is, one, is this person in a relationship with Jesus? That's a huge, for me, indicator of how I will approach it, right? If this person doesn't know Christ, I'm going to respect where they're coming from. I'm going to respect their desires because my goal is not to tell them they're wrong. My goal is for them to see Jesus mm-hmm. and for them to see my love. And hopefully the love and respect that I have for them builds a relationship where I can have conversations about Christ and what he did for us and allow Christ to change people, not my harsh judgment. If this person is a Christ follower, I think my approach might be a little bit different in the sense of I might still respect their desire for the name or the gender, but I think I would say, hey, let's have a conversation about this and let's talk about where God stands on this. And, you know, I might ask some questions like, hey, why do you feel like this is okay? Why are you living in this manner? I think that's how I would approach it, but I think relationship is really important in mm-hmm. this journey, and where they stand spiritually is another really important factor that should kind of gauge how we handle these situations.
Yeah. I would add to that, Preston Sprinkle in his book Embodied has a whole chapter on this where he presents both cases, 10 reasons. I think there's a Gospel Coalition article that's 10 reasons why you shouldn't use the pronoun. And then there's another article that probably gets put out, 10 reasons why you should. Mm-hmm. But I think that was context. I think Drew hasn't been in any of these arguments that I've read, which I think is super helpful that you drew out. Beth, do you have anything to add?
No, I don't think so. Not really. I mean, I think I agree that I guess my advice would be that we should always be thinking about what the goal is. And if you are going to just use the pronouns that the person wants, then still have a bigger goal than that. Mm. You know, if it's someone you're in relationship with or you're going to see on a regular basis, how can you eventually get to the point where you are sharing the gospel with that person? Yeah. Or, you know, there are opportunities to go deeper.
Yeah.
I think it's easy to say, well, out of compassion and love, sometimes it depends on where you land on these, but I think sometimes it's easy to say in compassion and love, I just want to respect the other person's wishes, but then we don't go further than mm-hmm. that.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So being able to say, yeah, I'm going to do it, but I'm going to do it with the goal of having opportunities to share the gospel with them.
Mm. Awesome. That's good. That's good. Now we're going to get practical about the workplace. So thinking about people who are in the workplace with workplace relationships, question sent in is, when is the time to take the stand for biblical principles and values in the workplace when potentially that may mean demotion, losing a job altogether, or maybe even just being seen as a bigot or someone who's, you know, not loving and not compassionate? When is the appropriate time? Is there any guiding principles that you would give to a person in this situation?
Go ahead, Beth. We'll let you start this one.
Well, I think similar to the pronoun question, there's not a black and white mm-hmm. answer to this. You know, I think that context matters. I think the person who is facing this issue matters. Their own conscience matters.
Yeah.
You know, so for one person, they might really feel like, I cannot support what my workplace is doing. It goes against my conscience. Yeah. It violates my conscience. And okay, they might need to take a stand. That might be the thing they need to do. For another person, maybe they're like, you know, this is not what I believe, but I'm going to try to walk this path in a way that makes it clear in some capacity where I stand, or I have a goal of why I'm still going to come along with the organization mm-hmm. the way they want me to. And they might be right in doing that. So that's my first thought is, and I know that's really frustrating because we want answers. We want to know, what am I supposed to do? Should I just be like, nope, yeah. I'm standing for truth? Or,
And my question is what does taking a stand mean?
Yeah.
You know, right. Does it mean hey, I need to have a one-on-one conversation with my supervisor because this compromises my convictions? I would say,
I think
that's a helpful stand, you know, in that regard. Yeah. Does it look like responding to a company like wide email and hitting reply all and then typing out your beliefs. I don't know if I would ever recommend someone doing that, you know, like what does taking a stand mean in that context? Now, if it's grace-filled one-on-one conversation, like I think if it's compromising, using the principles that you just shared, Beth, I think that could be really helpful.
Yeah, I think you take a stand when you're forced to compromise, right? Mm-hmm. I think that is the black and white answer. Anytime someone is forcing you to do a sinful thing, you take a stand. But mm-hmm. outside of that, I think God has given us a conscience. And that conscience, like you said, Beth, is different for different people. I think I know a lot of people that would say, no, I can't do that. I got to get out. And I know a lot of people are like, this is my mission field. And this is where I want to stay and engage and not lose my voice for people who might need it. And so
a good reference point in our media just in this last year, a few months ago, a few Tampa Bay players, right? They would fit that kind of this compromise of them choosing not to put the logo on their jerseys. Mm-hmm. And they had an individual conversation with their team. And then they had an individual conversation with their management and their leadership. And they asked if they could do this. And their management, leadership, and team respected them and said, okay, in light of your beliefs, we'll allow you to do this. And then obviously they got like canceled in the media. Sure. And there are some people who's, you know, had comments about them, but the way they approached it was, in my opinion, probably one of the best ways you could approach it. It was very humbling and grace-filled that it seemed to be on how they thought this thing was compromising their personal convictions and how they chose to progress in that.
And I think that that's an important point too. Like, yes, approach it with humility, but then also be okay with the fact that there may be negative consequences.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we don't represent Christ well when we get really angry that people don't like us for what we believe.
Right.
Yeah.
So if you feel like it's an issue you need to take a stand on, then continue having that humility if people hate you for it.
And be prepared for it.
Yes.
Right? Don't walk into it thinking, oh, I'm going to make the stand. I'm going to be the hero. And you're probably not going to be the hero. Yeah.
Right.
You're going to be hated for it. And, you know, hey, Jesus said, you know, you'll be hated for some of the things that he stood for.
Yeah, for sure. All right, now getting practical to the school context, specifically tied to, obviously there's like three groups of people that this may apply to. One is the employee, like a teacher, a school counselor, guidance counselor, administration, something like that. There's the parent, and there's also the student, thinking more probably college or high school age. How do I address this issue in my school? You know, we've already kind of talked about the employee, so maybe this circles back around to more parent-student. How do you respond biblically in a mixture of grace and truth to this? Like, when is the right time to take the stand as a student and as a parent, and what might that stand look like?
Yeah. Can I say one thing about teachers first?
Yeah, go ahead.
I just think it's in schools especially, there is a lot of narrative being pushed in some schools about this. And I think that creates a lot of tension for teachers, in particular Christian teachers.
Yeah.
And I don't think this is a black and white issue. I think different people have to make different decisions depending on their convictions. But, man, I hope that there are Christian teachers who stick it out. I hope that we have Christian teachers who stay in public education and Christian counselors and who continue to wrestle through those tensions that we are facing in public education right now. Because if all of the Christians leave, that is very scary.
Yeah.
And so, you know, does that mean that every single Christian teacher needs to stick it out? And, you know, definitely not. Some, you might be in a position where your conscience is not allowing it. The school is pushing it so hard. But I would just encourage teachers that if you're wrestling with this issue, you're not alone. And man, we need Christians. We need lights in dark places. So.
Yeah. Well
said. So good.
I think when it comes to the parents, I think the first stand you need to make is with your kids, right? Train your kids in godly ways, right? And, you know, the Bible says it's not a promise, it's a principle in Proverbs. Train them up in the way and they will not depart. And so I, you know, if I'm with my kids, I have four kids. The first thing I'm doing, I'm not fighting the schools. I'm training my kids.
Right.
I'm pouring God into my kids. I'm teaching them the ways of the Lord. And I think parents, don't get so caught up in fighting political battles and school battles that you miss out on training who you're who your kids are and the foundation that they need. And, you know, I think in with the schools and stuff, I think the nice part is we live in America and you have the ability as a parent to decide, right? Decide, hey, I'm going to send my kids to public school and I know I have to be maybe more aware to these things. Or, hey, you have the ability to send your kids to a Christian school or homeschool. We have the freedom to choose what's best and what we believe is best for our kids. And again, I don't think that's a black and white. I think if you're a parent today and you're sending your kids to public school, I think that's a wise and great choice. I think if you do something different, that's okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think in terms of how to address this issue as Christians, if you're a parent and you don't like what is happening at your child's school, you know, I don't think storming the school is usually helpful.
I recommend pitchforks and, you know, no.
But I think that there are ways to have conversations that include biblical principles without even talking about the Bible. You know, I think in my talks, I talked number four. Okay. I talked about, you know, natural law as being a part of that too, that we can have conversations about, well, how do we, again, not because of moral reasons or biblical reasons, but how do we really make sure that we're actually helping people who are saying that they're transgender? You know, there's hormones that they can start when they're young, puberty blockers, surgical transition, which is often a decade-long process, and it's very difficult and can be very painful. You know, is promoting or affirming a gender transition always the best choice, even if you're morally neutral on it,
right,
you know?
Yeah.
And so I think there are ways to have conversations that can be wise and helpful without, you know, feeling like I need to go in and tell them that they're wrong and this is why they're wrong.
Yeah.
Well, that's super helpful. We have two more scenarios that we want to go through before we wind down this conversation. And the first one is tied to a general friends and family. So in general with friends and family, and this could also go to the student in the local school because they're friends and their classmates and things like that. How do they navigate those relationships? And the question that gets specifically sent in is, when do I know to start the conversation? If it's someone that I have a long-standing existing relationship with, like this person's been in relationship with these people for maybe their entire life if they're family members, or at least a couple of years if they're friends, and assuming that let's assume that it's either someone who identifies with that community of the LGBTQAI or at least affirms that community of the worldview and the perspective of other trans people, and they're arguing that it's not morally wrong. There's nothing wrong with that. How do they open up a conversation? Do they just dive in? Do they wait till the other person is pushing their views and they brought up the conversation? How do you navigate that?
Well, man, I don't know. I mean, I think that it's hard without knowing all of those context variables, because that's where my mind goes. I want to know all the details.
Sure,
And you laid out a bunch of it, but I still, you know, I think, where are you? What are you doing? What was being talked about before?
Yeah.
When you get into those kinds of debates, how do they usually end? Are you like screaming at people by the end? Might not be wise.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, you have to know yourself. I think you have to know how you handle, you know, something that can get very political, very quickly.
Yep.
And if that is a fiery topic for you, then, you know, you might need to use some extra restraint.
And in knowing yourself, you're specifically probably referencing one of your talks where you talked about, are you more of a grace person or more of a truth person where you land on, I just need to tell you what's right.
Yes.
Or do you land more on the side of, oh, it's okay. Like, I'm going to have grace with you of like just accepting someone else's view. So where are you at on that sliding scale of grace and truth?
Yeah,
this is personal for me. I have, you know, in my family, I have someone who is a homosexual and someone who has transitioned to a different gender. And so, again, not black and white, a lot of, you know, outside circumstances that influence. I've always just tried to lean on asking a question versus making a statement.
Yeah.
I think questions are way less intimidating than declaring what I think and how I view. And what I've found to be true is when I ask questions, they come across as I'm interested, as I want to know you better. And it's led to conversations where I'm able to speak truth in a loving and kind way versus a judgmental type of way. And I am, again, I think what's really important, especially with family and close friends, is what's true for me, the more comfortable I am with somebody, the easier it is for me to get out of control.
Sure.
You know, with someone I don't know, I'm usually pretty mild mannered, but if I'm comfortable with someone, I have a tendency to say maybe some things I normally wouldn't. And so I think you have to be careful with family too, because it's really easy to get really comfortable and not think before you say something.
Yep.
And remember, I think you said it really good, Beth. What is your goal? Yeah. Is it just to have a conversation, or is the goal to slowly shift the way of thinking?
Mm-hmm.
And so if you have a goal, what is the trajectory of that goal? If you sit around and just talk about their life and how good it is, I don't know if you're really moving towards that goal. And so constantly keep that in the back of your mind.
Yeah. And I also think that that brings up a good point too, that, you know, ultimately, if the person is not saved, the real goal is the gospel.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you convince someone that staying their biological sex is the best way to be, but they're far from God, that's still not great.
Yeah.
That is a significant problem still. So, you know, it's okay to have these conversations. I think there is a time and a place, and it can be wise to engage in them, but also keeping in mind that if our conversations never include the gospel, then we've really missed the mark.
Yeah, yeah. You're treating symptoms rather than the actual sickness.
We have like two or three more questions as we wind down, but let's get a little bit more personal in this regard. What about parents of children, specifically children out of the house, adult children who are living lifestyles that are different than they disagree with? Because some of these conversations may be the deciding factor of, do I no longer get my family at Christmas?
Yeah.
That's the reality of it. Of if I have this conversation, they're not going to come around again. What kind of advice or thoughts would you give to maybe parents in that season of life?
I would say a couple of things. One, prayer is a powerful thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so never stop being on your knees, praying for your kids, for God to, I think I have to constantly remind myself, I don't change hearts. I don't change minds. God does.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's go to the one who actually can do the work that we can't do. Secondly, I know one of the big questions Ashley and I ask ourselves a lot is, what if this happens to one of our children, you know, on holidays? Are they allowed to come to our house? Are they allowed to celebrate? I've always just leaned on the side of grace there and having a voice into my child's life. And so I've always told my kids, they are always welcome at our house, no matter how what they're choosing to do, I want them to have a safe place where I can have a voice in their lives. Now, I understand there are different ways to approach that. And I think, again, I don't think there's a black and white. I just lean on the side of like, I want to have a voice in my child's life to preach the gospel to them, to love them and care for them, to see the change that only God can produce.
Yeah. And I would add to that a book that might be helpful called Space at the Table by Drew.
And we'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah.
We'll look it up.
Okay.
If it's written by a guy named Drew, you know it's got to be
good.
But it's actually written by a father and his son. So the father is a theologian and he teaches at a college or university, and his son is gay. And it's a very open, honest book. It's like painful to read at times, just because they talk about missing the mark with each other at various times through his son's adolescence and young adulthood, but how they have found a way to really maintain a relationship in a hard space. Yeah. And it's just encouraging and thought provoking. And so if you are a parent who's wrestling with this issue, I'd really encourage you to read that book because it's co-written by both of them. You hear both sides of the story, and I think just gives you greater awareness of how complicated it really it is.
Yeah.
What about with young kids? This is our last question. Do we wait until they get this thrown in their face and they start asking questions? You know, with, we could talk about how kid and family movies are changing with characters or the school system. We could talk about many things, but do we wait or do we blindside them with bringing up conversations with them depending on how young they are or old they are? Like, how are young parents, like, inform me? You know, I got almost 2-year-old and a 1-year-old. When do I start these conversations?
I don't know if there's a right time. I think it's an understanding of your kid's maturity, how prepared they are. So I don't know if you could say, oh, of course, by age 9, you got to get it done, right? Mm-hmm. But I think you need to have these conversations. And I would always lean on the side of, I'd rather start the conversation than let somebody else start the conversation.
Absolutely. And I also think that, you know, do you need to explain LGBTQ to a 4-year-old? Maybe not. But can you explain over and over again how God has a design for them as a boy or as a girl, and that God's design for marriage is between a man and a woman, and that we love and respect all people because they were made in the image of God? Yeah. Those are 3 points that we can reinforce from the time our kids are toddlers, and they're directly applicable to this issue. Yeah. So I think, you know, don't feel like it has to be a conversation about LGBTQ issues. It can be starting with those foundational principles and building from there when the opportunities come.
I actually think the foundation is way more important than responding to a cultural issue, right? Yeah. Let's teach our kids the way God designed us. There's actually, my wife has a great set of books, and I don't know the name, I can probably find them, that teaches, like, it's like age specific and how you slowly introduce your kids to just the differences in male and female. And it slowly progresses to sexuality, to sex, and all these things that are age appropriate, that build the way God designed things. And that's, I think, good. Parents need to be a little more aggressive with this, right? That's, I think, good. We have sat back and just said, oh, well, I'll let so-and-so raise your kids, right? Or whatever. Like, no, we need to, God entrusted us with our kids. And so we need to be proactive with their biblical education and their foundation, not the church, but we as parents. We will partner with you as a church. Yeah. We'll do anything we can, but man, parents, we got to be aggressive at teaching our kids a Christian worldview and foundation from the Bible.
Yeah. That's phenomenal. If you could find those, we'll put them in the show notes, along with one other resource as we wind down, Mama Bear Apologetics, The Guide to Sexuality. Yes. It's a great read. My wife and I have been reading it together. And so, well, thanks so much for listening to this bonus episode on question and answers that you've sent in from the feedback form around this Equip class, What Does the Bible Say About Gender Identity? One more push. If you haven't listened to the first 4 episodes, please go and do that. It'll be so helpful in light of this conversation and many others as we seek to love all those that God has intentionally designed. We'll see you next week.